Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number one of Journeys, podcast on transportation. I'm your host, Matteo Bellotto, and today we're joined by Marianne Jiang. Marianne has over a decade of international experience in urban policy, governance, and sustainable development. Most recently, she worked for 100 Resilient Cities, a nonprofit dedicated to helping cities build resilience to physical, social, and economic challenges. There, she worked on the intersection of transport, land use, and urban resilience to develop the concept of resilient transport. She's currently advising other nonprofits on sustainable urban development approaches. Hi, Marianne.
Hi, Matteo. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So before we kind of get into some more questions, I'd like to just start with your background, where you're from, how you got started in urban planning and transportation, et cetera.
Yeah, I'm basically a big city inhabitant. I've been a big city inhabitant my entire life. I grew up in Hong Kong. I then moved to London, lived there for about 8 years, and then now I live in New York City. And in all these places, the thing that's you grow up with a different perspective when you live in big cities your whole life. You come to rely on a lot of public services like public transport, parks. You are very used to density. But what's interesting is that even though these are all big cities, they're all slightly different in different ways. In Hong Kong, there was definitely a lot more density. When I moved to London, it was something I recognized. And I wondered why in London there wasn't why there wasn't more. Then I moved to New York. And in New York, the thing that struck me the most was, the topic of our talk today, which is the public transport system and how different it is. My interest in all that led to my wanting to work in the field, how to make cities more livable, more sustainable, more resilient, especially now to climate change. And that's what I've done over the last about 15 years. I've worked in a design and engineering company based in London, and then I moved into a think tank. I worked briefly for the New York City Mayor's Office of Long-Term Planning and Sustainability, and then at a nonprofit that looked at sustainable urban development and principles. Finally with a global nonprofit that tried to disseminate that globally with cities around the world.
So actually another question I had just from what you're speaking about is Hong Kong, London, New York City. I'm kind of curious, what do you think unites those three cities? And then maybe, what's so different about them? What do they all have in common and what's different about them? And it doesn't have to be just in transportation, but overall kind of what you notice.
Yeah, it's, that's a very good question. I sometimes sort of think about that. So the thing that's, definitely in terms of the built environment, the commonalities are clear. There's lots of buildings. When you're on the street, you don't often see the sky from where you're standing because there's, usually a lot of buildings in your view. there's always a ton of people. There's always a lot of noise. A lot of the commonalities are very physical. But the differences are all sort of, for me, very cultural. The way that people carry themselves in Hong Kong versus New York versus London, very different, and it obviously ties back to, the cultural practices of these places. I mean, there's similarities in Hong Kong and London in that, and I don't know, it has to do with the fact that Hong Kong was at one point a British colony, but people are very keep to themselves. There's a lot of, if something happens on the street, there's an incident on the street, I find. In most cases in Hong Kong and London, people will not intervene. They will, if there's if they see a mugging or, they may in some cases, but in a lot of cases, there's a lot of individual, sticking, not poking your nose at somebody else's sort of business. But it was interesting in New York, I don't find that. New York is, for all the cultural, imagery out there of New York being a really unfriendly sort of brusque sort of place, people here are actually very communal, and if something was to happen to someone on the street, everyone around them in the within the very close radius of this incident would stop and try to help out, which I thought was really interesting. On the other hand, and people are rude, there's a lot of shoving and get out the way and you're walking too slow, but on the other hand, there's a lot of people who if something happens, there are people people stop to call the ambulance, you know, stop, you know, if there's someone who's doing a mugging, stop that person, you know, it's just, it's really sort of interesting for me. And that cultural side is, you know, what makes these places so, I mean, I think that's what people fall in love with when they fall in love with Hong Kong, London, or New York. I mean, the architecture and the, you know, and the physical, the way the city looks physically is one thing, but I think you, if you fall in love with the city, you fall in love with the culture and the people and, you know, what it's like.
That's very interesting because, you know, in one way you say that you notice that the differences are cultural, but, you know, do you think that any times kind of the cultural differences then play into maybe the structure of the city or the form of the city? You know, because I know in Hong Kong, like with the feng shui, like the buildings themselves are, you know, structured, you know, in that manner. So I'm curious, you know, if it ever plays a role in urban planning at all, or if, you know, most cities are kind of structured in similar ways.
I think for me, it's like with these cities, a lot of it has to do I think, with the history, you know, of the place, like when it started, when did it become a city? Like, when did it go from just being a collection of homes, a village, into an actual city? I think with a lot of cities, the development of a city, the urban development, has a lot to do with sort of what technology was dominant at the time. So, you know, I don't know the history of Hong Kong's development, but, you know, in Hong Kong, at first it was, Hong Kong's a very rocky island, and, you know, there's a lot of places where you could not construct homes. And so a lot of the homes were, you know, I mean, yeah, a lot of them were on the low-lying land, sort of close to the harbor. You know, and there was a lot of density because in Hong Kong there's not enough space, you know, as in there was a lot of area in which you could not build at the time. You know, I think in Hong Kong there's these amazing construction methods for how to, you know, build on sloped, no longer volcanic, but sloped rock. You know, have these like special cantilevered buildings. I don't exactly know what the phrase is, but you know, and that's you know, and that's only been available to Hong Kong probably in the last few decades because, you know, of technology. You know, and similarly in London, I think you know, London's essentially a agglomeration of 38, I think, little villages, and you know, the ability for that to become Greater London has largely to do with, you know, transportation and the ability to move freely between these villages, and then the infill that happened between them. And then, yeah, I mean, and New York is, you know, I think down, you know, it's kind of clear in New York too, like downtown where you know, development first started, it's all sort of like an old European city, you know, the streets aren't necessarily built for the cars, you know, they're narrow, they're one way. And then, you know, and then as New York started to grow, and obviously cars are very available at the time, you know, the streets that we get, that you see now, the wide avenues, you know, those are definitely all geared towards car transport, I can tell.
Yeah, so I'd love to kind of go into cars and how they shape cities. But first, I kind of want to start with your definition of a resilient transport system. Now, I know, well, now you define a resilient city as a city that has the ability to absorb, recover, and prepare for future shocks. Those shocks can be economic, environmental, social, or institutional, or a combination of them. And I guess COVID is a good example of how they kind of intersect. But, you know, resilient cities promote sustainable development, well-being, and inclusive growth. So what does a resilient transportation system look like in the context of a resilient city?
That is an excellent question. And I do have a white paper that I wrote, which I hope is still available online while I was at 100 Resilient Cities. And it has my definition of a resilient transport system in it. So rather than just read that definition, which is sort of available, I can just talk through sort of what I think the principles are.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah, I mean, so I think there's a couple of things. One is that a city that thinks about its transport, you know, a resilient transport system is understanding that transport is one of many systems in a city that help a city, you know, become more sustainable and help a city be prepared for the next, you know, disaster or crisis. And that system zero, I think, is really important because it doesn't, not only is it clear that transportation is just one of many elements, and so you have to think about everything in an integrated way, but also I think allows the transportation department, or, you know, whoever the sort of decision makers and the budgetary holders are, to understand that you have to see transport as a mode of achieving your citywide goals. And you know, the aim is not to create a hardened transportation system that will withstand all manner of disasters. That's not the end goal. The end goal is, how do we create a transport system that is going to support economic growth, you know, more equal access to opportunities and outcomes, as well as be prepared for the next disaster. So it's sort of a combination of those things, and that's I think that's the most important thing to think about, and it sort of leads on to all these other these other principles that are important. So definitely understanding the interdependency between transportation and energy, water, waste, health, education, the economy and society. Definitely understanding the risks to transportation, whether natural or man-made, thinking about how to integrate the awareness of, the independent interdependencies of other systems and the potential risks and vulnerabilities to the system, thinking about how to integrate those things when you're doing your transport planning or your asset management or your operational planning. Both, and as many ways you could do this, but one is to outline these things in a sort of transport slash mobility strategy, where you lay out a vision for how you think your transport infrastructure you can support the many citywide goals you have. And also, importantly, lay out plans for how you're going to prepare for an emergency and the recovery afterwards.
So you say, right when you started speaking, and I think, and before we started recording, you talked about a systems viewpoint towards a city. Mm-hmm. So can you kind of describe what that is and how it kind of orients your vision of urban planning and transportation planning?
Yeah, systems viewpoint is just sort of a way of appreciating complexity, and understanding that, yes, there are many disciplines and, many topics, and that those are, that, and it's an appreciation that looking at something from a single discipline or some single sort of topical point of view, it's really just an entry point to thinking about the city. So, and that you have to appreciate everything else. So it's like saying, so it's like the difference between someone who thinks about transportation just in terms of, okay, well, how many kilometers of road do we have? How many stations do we have? How many trains, do we have? How many buses do we have? And just thinking about how to maximize and efficient, make that more efficient, versus someone who's saying, what is the purpose of the transportation system? How do we make sure that, what is the purpose of the transportation system in our city? More broadly, not just how do we keep a good level of service, but, thinking about a good transportation system is one that helps students get to school on time, makes it easier for people to get to their jobs, allows for efficient deliveries, ensures that also fulfills other goals like promotes people's health and well-being, maybe by making sure they're more active mode, so they're walking or they're cycling more than they're taking than they're driving in a car, I think there's also recognizing that transportation occupy space in the city, whether it's the stations, whether it's the parking spaces that you offer for free or that you charge for, whether it's just the sheer amount of road space that there is for cars versus other uses, and recognizing that that has an impact too on the city. These are not just arterials and infrastructure that's purely just for, single purpose. Like, that doesn't exist anymore. Cities are diverse places where so many things happen. And I think increasingly, I'm not sure what the trend is, but citizens themselves are starting to think differently about the city and spaces. And so now, you also have to think about the fact that you have to recognize that maybe these roads that were once just dedicated for cars, or these spaces that were once dedicated for car parking, you know, you have to think about these differently as well.
So I'm kind of curious, you know, you said that in a holistic view of transportation for a city, first you start with your goals, you talk about a city that promotes economic growth, that's sustainable. So you have that holistic view, and then transportation is kind of one of the means to an end, or one of the ways of kind of enforcing that and helping that grow. So, you know, today, the major cities of the world are planned around automobiles. You know, why aren't automobiles the main mechanism or the best tool for economic growth or for sustainability? You know, why would having a more robust transportation system, you know, be more beneficial for the average city living citizen?
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, for the earlier part of, you know, the last century, I think most people thought, you know, the car is going to liberate us, and, you know, we'll be, you know, we all be driving to our jobs and, you know, in our massive car parks, and, you know, we'll have all this, you know, we'll all be able to move around individually without having to be stuck on public transport with a bunch of, with the masses or whatever. But as you can tell, like, I think the last half a century and more has shown us what the problems are with the car, and it's, you know, it's fairly well known, but you know, I don't even know where to start. So many problems with the car.
Yeah, it's quite a broad question. Maybe we could start with, like, our current cities are planned. How are current cities planned? They're planned around vehicles, right? So why is that a negative thing?
Why is that negative? Well, so I mean, the problems with the car are, you know, cars are dirty. They emit a lot of negative, you know, particulates, you know, CO2, bad both for the climate, but also just immediate air pollution. You know, so terrible impact on health and air pollution. And those are, like, some of the biggest problems that especially large cities, you know, London, Hong Kong, like, are having, Seoul. The other problem that's the major problem is that they just take up too much space. I think, you know, cities are places that are dense, and, you know, people live in apartments that are, you know, barely the size of, I mean, you know, in small, very small apartments. And if all these people were to own cars, where would they all be parked? I mean, the largest issue is just the amount of land they take up, both when they're parking and when they're sort of in use. Yeah, the climate change and sort of the environmental impacts, and then the health impacts, and then, you know, just the space impacts. I mean, those are, you can unpack that more, but those, I think, are the top three. They're not good for the environment. They're not really good for people's health, because then you're stuck in a sedentary vehicle and you're not really, you know, it's not an active mode. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
No worries.
Yeah.
So I'm curious then, like, how would, you know, pedestrianization, like, let's take New York City, for example. So how would that look? How would it look if, you know, New York City decides to really prioritize public transportation, pedestrianization, and starts to eliminate, you know, the roads? Wouldn't that create more congestion? You know, how would that look in reality?
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of everything. It's not just design, but it has to be, and, you know, it has to go hand in hand with, like, policies and, you know, and programs that help people get on public transit. So, like, in an ideal city, and I've done a lot of this sort of, like, ideal city visioning when in one of my first jobs, because we would, like, design, like, eco cities for China.
This is actually my last question was, like, very utopian, like, what does your ideal city look like? But I guess if you could address it now, then, you know, what does your ideal transportation oriented city look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's, and I'm sure it exists somewhere, probably in the Netherlands or something, but, you know, it's the way to do it, I mean, is I don't know how you retrofit a city to do this, but, you know, an ideal city is one where, the primary mode, you know, it's designed around the fact that most people want to be able to walk to whatever their services are. Not only does it save time, but it's pleasant, you know, especially if there's trees on the street, if the weather is sort of cooperative, you know, and it's a nice way to be able to socialize with people and, you know, and just as a human experience, being outside and, you know, being in one's environment. It's just, you know, a pleasant way to get around. And so I think a lot of, in my ideal world, you know, and I don't know how large a city this would be, how many people, anything like this, but it would, you know, be the primary way of getting around, fulfilling most of your needs, maybe like your shopping, your healthcare needs, your educational needs, possibly, you know, maybe your job. I'm not sure how feasible that was, would be to be able to walk to it. Like, and it would be like a 10-15 minute walk max, I suppose, like what the mayor of Paris is proposing. The primary infrastructure for getting around would be pleasant walking spaces, you know, sort of level, maybe paved. There's no need for curb cuts because the surface is just made for all manner of people with all manner of abilities to walk. So if you're in a wheelchair, you don't have to find a curb cut to go up. You know, it's just, and if you have strollers, you don't have to, you know, do the same thing. It's just all sort of a nice, you know, flat surface for people to just walk everywhere they need to. And then I guess the other modes on top of that would be, you know, obviously cycling. And if you want to go further distances, is, you know, then using public transport. Improving the walking environment improves everything because cyclists can use a walking environment. I mean, they'd have to be respectful of the pedestrians who are walking on it because there'll be many people, you know, everywhere. But you could also, you know, designate separate cycling lanes. But cycling lanes can be as easy as, you know, it can just be on the same surface with some protection on either side of the lane so that people aren't just wandering into the bike lane. You don't need to do anything special for, for a bike. You don't have to do any special treatment for a bike lane, unlike a car lane. And if you improve the walking environment and you make it easier for people to just walk around wherever they need to, it'll be very easy for people to walk to a transit stop, to a bus station or a train station, and you line up some bike racks, you know, so people can park, the train or the bus has space for you to store your bike on it. And then you take the bus or the train station, the train to get to your to wherever you need to, that's a little bit further away. And in my ideal world, the bus and the train station have real-time information at the stop, so you know how long you have to wait for the next train or the train after that. And there's easy ways for you to figure out where the bus or the train goes, so you can figure out your route easily. There's a really simple, easy way of paying for these modes, whether it's contactless payment or I don't know, maybe it's even free. That would be amazing. That's a world in which mobility is really easy, and it's not a difficult choice. You know, do I take the bus, do I take the train, how long do I have to wait? A city where mobility, you don't have to think about it too much because just so easy to get to the things you need and affordable and quick.
So then, along those lines, in the beginning of what you're saying, you talked about a city where everything was kind of a 10-15 minute walk. So I guess I now like a transition to the concept of a 15 minute city. For those who don't know it, I'll quickly just define it. So the 15 minute city was a concept developed primarily to reduce carbon emissions, reimagining towns not only as discrete zones for living, working, and entertainment, but as mosaics of neighborhoods in which almost all residents' needs can be met within 15 minutes of their homes on foot, by bike, or on public transit. And as workplace, stores, and homes are brought into closer proximity, street space previously dedicated to cars is freed up, eliminating pollution and making way for gardens, bike lanes, sports, and leisure facilities. All of this allows residents to bring their daily activities out of their homes and into welcoming, safe streets and squares. Carlos Moreno, the scientific director specializing in innovation at the University of Paris, says the 15-minute city represents the possibility of a decentralized city. At its heart, the concept of mixing urban social functions to create a vibrant vicinity replicated like fractals across an entire urban expanse. So that in a way is, you know, quite utopian. The idea that, you know, within 10-15 minutes, almost all of your needs besides your work can be met in this space. And I'm curious, you already, showed maybe your approval for this idea, but, can you see that working practically in major cities from London to Hong Kong? Can you even see that model being placed in all these different cities with all these different plans, all different types of geography. I mean, is this something practical or, you know, beneficial and something that can be replicated kind of uniformly across different cities?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm pretty sure that yes, the 15-minute city is definitely more of a concept and sort of guiding principles, and you know, cities want to sort of head that way. I don't think, if your question is like, do you think that there can actually be 15-minute, like, can the city just be made up of 15-minute hamlets, say?
Sure,
like,
sure.
Can it just be like 115-minute hamlets, and that's like. Mm. And I don't think that's really going to happen. That's definitely, you know, the whole point, not the whole point, but, you know, a major draw of a city is, is its size and its, you know, and the diversity of things that happen. And, you know, and then by its nature, you know, sort of people and all different industries are, you know, sort of, you know, coexisting in one big space. So a city is always going to be diverse and complicated and all that. But I do agree with the 15, and I do approve of the 15-minute concept that, you know, most of your needs, not all of them, like maybe not your job, maybe not where you go to school, maybe not where you get your healthcare treatment. But a lot of the basic things you should be able to get within like a 10-15 minute walk. There should be a good library near you where you can borrow a book. There should be good supermarkets near you where you can get fresh food, and you should be able to have a choice about the different sort of places where you get your food. There should be a good place where you can, you know, there should be a park, definitely should be a park, and places where, you know, you can get access to green space, and, you know, for all the health and stress benefits, you know. You know, and sort of other cultural and you know, recreational services, like, you should have a decent choice, like, within 10-15. I agree. You know, you might not be able to have you might not live within 10-15 minutes of NYU or Columbia University, but
sure,
you know, that you
no,
can
but
travel.
It makes sense, like a guiding overall, yeah, like structural or design, like a thesis almost, like, this is how we should ideally try to orient things. But, you know, on that line of thought, it seems like European cities are kind of ahead of the ball or ahead of the game in regard to the US. I mean, Barcelona, Paris, Madrid, they all seem like they're showing a lot of initiative in that direction. So I'm wondering, you know, the US historically doesn't have great public transportation outside of some of its major cities, maybe Chicago, Washington, DC, New York. You know, I'm wondering, why does the US lack in this regard? Are we just really in love with our vehicles, or why are we different from the European cities?
Well, I mean, I think it comes down a lot to history, and, you know, the fact that these cities, a lot of the older European cities were built at a time when, you know, there were like horse-drawn carts, or, you know, before pre-vehicle, many of them, right? And so their road layouts are already conducive to this, like, to removing the car. I mean, so many, you've been to a lot of European cities, there's a lot of one-way streets, there's a lot of, you know, like, roads, like, that, you know, and it's very easy to get lost, right? That's the thing I love doing in London, is going and getting lost. It's not easy to get lost in New York or in American cities. It's definitely, you know, it's a grit. But it's low hanging fruit in some ways for European cities to say, you know, we're gonna take the cars off, you know, the streets in our very downtown historic centers, you know, and only allow pedestrians or bikes or public transport. You know, like they did that in Mexico City too, where, you know, I think there's like a central historic district where I think only the BRT and cyclists and pedestrians can walk, but they've gotten rid of the personal car. Yeah. And that's what they've done in Barcelona with the super blocks. I mean, in the US, I think, you know, New York is an obvious place, or cities that have an old historic center are obvious places to do this. And so that PWA proposal that you talked about, where they pedestrianize all of, you know, south of 40th Street in New York City. I mean, if it was a European city, I bet I don't know if they start with under south of 40th Street. They might start with like the Wall Street area, like the financial district. They might just pedestrianize most of that, and except for some of the major corridors. You know, it could happen here. I think it's just, I'm sure it's a combination of sort of political will and also, you know, there are stronger interests here, I think, for personal vehicles. And there's not so much support in this country for public transport, not as much as in Europe, but it has to do also with sort of like reliance on it. And the level of service, and that also has to do sort of with, you know, how it's paid for, and who makes decisions about the different systems.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that because, you know, I think about New York City a lot in terms of how it's been transformed by the automobile, because, you know, it was like the grid system, or New York kind of came to life right before the automobile. And so, you know, there's these amazing images of, you know, they, like they say, and there's a documentary about New York City, and one of the people they interview says, you know, there's these images, and he's talking over, and there's these images of said, like, the street is where everyone interacted. So there'd be kids playing, markets, mm-hmm. you know, the community would kind of congregate on the streets of New York City. And as soon as the car yeah. came, you know, it pushed people inside their houses onto this very small sidewalks. And, you know, we can talk about Robert Moses, for example, the way that he, you know, totally transformed New York City. So, you know, clearly it took political will to turn New York City into an automobile first city. I mean, the Cross Bronx, Bronx and Spray Expressway, I mean, literally like going through neighborhoods, yeah. destroying them, building highways. So yeah. on the line of political will, you know, I know that you've seen up close how city government works and kind of how hard it is to get things through. You know, what does it take? Or what will it take for us to kind of almost reverse the kind of car-led transformations of the, you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s?
Yeah. That is $1 million question, maybe the $1 trillion question. I think it's, I don't know if I'm jaded, but, you know, because the first thing that comes to mind when you ask this question is like money, basically. You know, one of the key things that we need is money immediately to like shore up our public transport system, you know, and because for me, I think what's needed, especially in US cities, is a lot more support from the public as well for public transport and wanting to walk and cycle. You know, it's in this country, it definitely starts from the constituents saying, this is what we want. And then that goes up to the political representatives. And then that goes up higher and higher. And, you know, eventually the people at the top will make the decision that reflects what people want, you know, but it really, for me, it's like, but, you know, you have to get people to buy into the idea that public transport is the way that we should do things. And I think the way that the way that we're going to win people's hearts and minds over to taking more public transport, walking, cycling, is by improving the infrastructure for them. You know, make the sidewalks nicer. You know, show what it looks like when you reduce car traffic on the street, or, you know, lower the speeds, or you know, plant more trees, put more benches so that people can walk. You know, change up, you know, allow more uses on the ground level so that, you know, you can have shops and, you know, there's more vibrant, you know, there's more activity on the street anyway. All the principles that like Dane Jacobs talked about.
So it's almost like, it's almost like paradoxical, like for people to yeah. want public transportation, you have to show them how good it is, or to get the political will, you have to kind of, you know, which one
it's
first?
In this, I would say yes, because it's like it's hard for people to just imagine this stuff. It's hard to sell people just on on just imagining or a vision of it. You know, like I feel like people really buy in and will show their vocal and other forms of support if this is something that they know experientially, this is what they want and this is what this is what they need. So I think, you know, you really do need to show people what it looks like when you change the street, and this is what it could be. And then people will say, well, this is, we want to keep this. And this is what, you know, but it's like you say, it is a bit of a catch-22, because, you know, like you need to, you know, how are you going to get the money for it if people don't support it? But I'm also saying that you need to do it in order to get people to support it. And I think this is the problem that most probably decision makers and budgetary holders have about, like, you know, they want to improve this infrastructure, you know, because they want to show people that, you know, it could be better and want more people to buy into it, but then they don't have the means in the first place.
Yeah, no, it's challenging. But, you know, there are signs of hope, like, you know, in New York City here with the open streets, open dining, you know, due to COVID, that, you know, the regulations were relaxed and restaurants were allowed to have build structures kind of on the sidewalk, following kind of regulations, and because it was so successful, now in a lot of streets in New York City, the restaurants now have these great open spaces next to the sidewalk. And I certainly think it adds to the community of the neighborhood of the area, people outdoors and eating. And...
Well, I think so, but there is one thought I have about that, which is, so, you know, the shared streets that you were talking about, where they closed off, you know, the streets at certain times of day, usually from 8 to 8, from traffic, and it was meant for more for walking pedestrian uses. So there's one where I live, it's about a 10 block stretch down here, and I think, and according to Google Maps, you know, that it's still meant to be a shared street, but those blue NYPD wooden, what do you call them, bollard things that would mark that this was a shared street, which by the way, it's just a blue painted thing that says NYPD do not enter. And there's like a laminated card that says shared street with in 14 point print that like nobody from, you know, across the street could read.
People think it's like a crime zone or a crime scene or something.
Yeah. And you're like, if you want to make this just a shared street, can we do something, please, that makes it abundantly clear to people who are in a city of a size of 8 million people that this is a freaking shared street? Like, can we could you paint it? I don't know. Could you put some more, you know, official looking signage that and make it clearly labeled that it's a shared street? Could you hang some banners maybe? I don't know, from like the lamppost and say, you know, there's a shared street from 8 to 8, and, you know, just make it clear, because, you know, now what's happened is that, those blue things are gone. That thing no longer operates as a shared street. I don't think it is anymore, or, I mean, I'm uncertain. But, you know, during the pandemic when there were no cars, my kids were scooting down there, biking on it. We would walk up and down it all the time. And now it's all cars on there. And I think it's still a shared street. But, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, you have to do more than just like put up a temporary thing and, you know, hope that, you know, behaviors will change. Like, you should invest in it and show people that, you know, the city is invested in it too. And, you know, it's, you know, I bet if they'd done that, there would be so much more support. And say the city then told us, okay, after you know, 10 months, okay, we have to pull this shared street because we don't have the funds to maintain it or operate it or something. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a group of people, local people within the radius of that shared street, would have pitched in to say, okay, we'll try and find a way to help you maintain and keep it open as a shared street, because everyone saw the benefit. Like, people were eating out there, set up picnic tables, you know. Being responsible, social distancing, and using, like you say, using that street, you know, in such an active and wonderful way. But like I say, without the investment, it doesn't stick.
No, that makes sense. And I think, you know, you're right, because I also see that in New York City, you know, with the 14th Street busway, you know, the plan was to totally clear 14th Street just for these special bus routes, and they would just go back and forth, and it was supposed to be very quick and efficient. And I actually took the bus, you know, for research. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no police enforcement. So even though the whole street is red, it literally says buses only, there's still cars turning left, going right, using them. You know, if you're as a car, you're supposed to just take your first turn, but cars would still take 14th Street there and back. And, you know, we asked the question, why is that happening? And it's because, you know, there's no enforcement. So it almost takes more political will to really make sure that it functions. You know, they should add cameras or something, and, you know, a way of punishment if you stay on the street. But, you know, slow and steady. And eventually, I think that behavior would kind of get ingrained. But, you know, what you're talking about, you know, public investment, you know, Joe Biden's new transportation plan. I know when new administrations come in, they always have grand, big schemes, but it seems like this is something that's really been talked about a lot. And in the transition plan, Biden aims, and this is a quote here, to provide every American city with 100,000 or more residents with high quality, zero emissions public transportation options. And he's talking about, you know, upwards of $40 billion of investment. And what I found really fascinating about that was the amount of money it would take to ensure kind of high quality transportation. That, like, in terms of federal aid, is about $45 billion. The amount of money we spend on highways every year is about $46 billion from the federal government. So I'm kind of curious, what do you think about the Biden administration's plans? Have you seen this before, where grand plans kind of get put out there, but they don't get initiated? What role should the federal government play in subsidizing transportation? I know these are all broad questions, but I'm kind of curious your thoughts on them in general.
Yeah, I'm by no means an expert on, you know, the on how federal government works in terms of supporting public transportation. But I do know that federal governments, I think the amount the federal government actually contributes to the creation of transportation, I think is relatively small. It's more cities and states that fund their own, the majority of their own public transportation system. So, the thing about federal government, I think the most important role that it can play is I suppose the primary thing they do is by saying, okay, since we have these funds, and they often make those funds available to cities and states who can match funds, a lot of it is in like possibly driving some level of innovation and saying, that at the federal level, we believe that zero emissions transport modes are the most important, and I think this was done under the Obama administration too, but making grants available to cities and states that want to do that sort of investment, and so giving them seed capital that they then have to match, but it spurs more innovation that way to create more zero emission modes. I don't know about the track record of U.S. federal government in sort of announcing that they have this ideal great idea of a package that's got this price tag. Does it really go through? I don't often know, but in this case, I think in this country right now that there is I do believe that there is a awakening and recognition that public transportation is really important. And especially in the east and the west, the more urbanized areas, recognize this, no doubt. I'm hopeful that there will be enough members of the government, whether in Senate or Congress, who, will support some sort of a bill with a large number to invest in, public transportation in the future. I don't know exactly what will happen, but I'm pretty sure that there will be, I guess the question will just be, will it be geared towards, one thing I've heard a lot about Biden's plan, which I haven't actually read, but is, he wants to invest a lot in rail. Will it become a very rail focused bill? I don't know.
Sure.
or will there be interest in innovation in other modes? Because, to your point, I think the thing about public transport is that it's expensive to run, right? And it has to somewhat be publicly provided, because if you wanted to make it affordable to the people who need it the most, it has to be subsidized, there's no two ways about it. Infrastructure is aging, and the older it gets, the more expensive it is to maintain and operate. If you need to do a renovation, that costs a lot of money too. And you still want to keep the prices low because it provides a public good. It allows people to get around across the city, as they need to. You don't want to make that like a market price, put it that way. You don't want to make people pay market prices for getting around. One other thought I've had is, what about more informal modes? If formal modes are so expensive, are there, more informal ways that people can get around? Obviously it's harder to imagine that in our westernized governments where, there are strict regulations on everything and, health and safety is an issue and all this sort of thing. But, there's this history in Hong Kong, we have something called the minibuses and you've ride them, right? With the yellow buses with the red or the green roof. They're they're sort of considered formal public transport now, but at one point they were informal. They were, not regulated. They just sort of took, you hail them on the street. You had to know where the stop was. There was no marked spot. You held them on the street, you got in, you don't have to clip yourself in. It's a 16-seater little mini bus. The driver didn't wear a car seat, a car seat. Nobody did. And you just shouted out your stop. That's like how you knew. That's how he knew to stop. And then that operated for one. And then I think later on it became, because it was so, I think the Hong Kong government saw this and they were like, and it was operating a lot more routes than the formal transportation system. And the government was like, okay, we're gonna ask if we can buy them out and formalize them, and they've made this informal public transport system part of quasi formal now, And then you can pay for it using the, you know, the Oyster card that you can pay every, and the Octopus card that you can use to pay other modes. And now there are signs like marking where the stops are. But, you know, I don't know. I just feel like, you know, maybe government cannot solve every single problem down to every single level, you know, that, you know, and so, you know, maybe there's a space there for other modes that are not, you know, and I think micromobility is probably filling that, you know, these e-scooters and those e-Vespas that are driving around, you know, that's giving people some flexibility to get around, you know, they don't have to use a fixed route like bus or train, you know, route that those things are using. But I don't exactly know what that solution is, but I'm sure there's a space there for
something
not formal, not necessarily walking and cycling.
Yeah, I know that makes sense. I mean, I know in like Santiago, for example, they have they're actually made in China, and they're like little rickshaws with bikes, and they're free, provided by the city. Mm-hmm. They're very effective. But you know, I only have a couple more questions, but. You know, in terms of other forms of transportation that aren't kind of dominated by the government, there's kind of a question about future technology, first about Hyperloop and then about electric cars. I guess first about Hyperloop, if that's something you want to talk about, I'm curious if you think that has the potential to really drastically change the way we think about long distance transport, or maybe that will enable the 15-minute city a bit more, because then you can live somewhere, hop in a Hyperloop portal, and then, you know, in 10 minutes, go hundreds or, you know, many, many miles. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, if you think Hyperloop or another future technology like that has the power to change the transportation landscape as we know it.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't know a ton about Hyperloop. I've read through one article about it. You know, but to me, I mean, I don't know how expensive it is to build Hyperloop and then to run it. I mean, I understand that it doesn't require a driver and therefore it might not be so expensive to run, but I'm sure the investment to build a tube that
has
all the
necessary... No, it's extremely expensive.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, if anything, maybe if like we can no longer fly planes, then maybe it makes sense to build these things below, two different continents or something. You know, maybe it can replace flight, but I don't know. I don't see a lot of promise in the Hyperloop. I just think it's too expensive, and we already, public transport is already expensive enough to build. We don't need something that's gonna cost way extravagantly more, and that's really not, I don't see a huge amount of benefit you know, in it. You know, the subway car carries a ton of people too, and you know, if you can, a subway system that runs efficiently could probably move the same number of people as a Hyperloop. I don't know, maybe it wouldn't, not as fast, but
more,
yeah, you know, it's probably, so I'm not sure, but maybe I'm just being slow, but maybe the Hyperloop is like before its time, like the Concorde, but
sure.
As of now, I would say not that. Not,
yeah,
that,
you know, moment. It's interesting, I've asked the Hyperloop question to everybody that I've spoken to on this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And most of the responses are, you know, there's this constant fixation on what's next and what's the savior technology, so to speak, when, you know, let's say, I've used this analogy a couple times, that like if God existed, he, you know, came down with a mandate that, you know, we can't innovate for 50 years and we have to work with what we have, that we have the skills and tools and technology necessary to create, you know, efficient, sustainable and effective cities. We don't need a Hyperloop. We don't need, you know, self-driving cars. We have the infrastructure and the tools and technology that exists already.
But the difficulty is like in having everybody agree on your vision. Like, does everyone, not everybody agrees on the vision, like not everyone agrees on what a sustainable city looks like, probably. Like, I mean, we all agree, okay, we want an environmentally sustainable city that's, you know, resilient to climate change and, you know, and it will support everyone's health and well-being, but like how you get there, nobody, I'm sure everyone, you know, so many different views on like how you get there and, you know, what you prioritize. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that, you know, makes it so interesting to work in the space, you know, but also probably makes progress a little slow, is that, you know, it's not, yeah, there are many, I guess there are many ways to achieve sustainability and, you know, and to be resilient, and there's only a finite amount of resources and, you know, and time. And it's like, okay, what do you prioritize first, you know? And actually at 100 resilient cities, I think we were trying to solve that through getting cities to write, to try and, you know, strategize, like have a vision, have a strategy, you know, city resilience strategy, lay it out, you know, and prioritize by asking your stakeholders, asking the citizens, like, you know, what's a priority for you, you know, and trying to like lay out a bit of a roadmap. I mean, most cities are trying to do that now, like, right, have a vision, have a roadmap, figure out how they're gonna get their city to move towards something more sustainable, more resilient. But it takes time, takes resources, takes will, and also takes not getting, you know, waylaid.
yeah, that makes sense. Okay, well, I'd like to kind of conclude with my final question. And before we get there, kind of on that note, you know, I was reading an article recently and it said that what's great about cooperation, or what allows kind of a lot more cooperation between cities, is that inherently they don't really compete. You know, they all kind of have a common interest of serving the citizenry that live there. And so there's a huge space, and I guess 100 resilient cities in a way was there, where you can kind of cooperate very effectively and find solutions that will work in one city. You can kind of replicate them to a degree in many other spaces, because there is no real competition. Like, you know, my system is better than yours, but I don't want to share it with you. You know, there is a lot of interchange. But anyway, to kind of conclude, I lost my train of thought quickly. To conclude, and this is again very broad, but, you know, for the next 10, 15 years, you know, how do you think, what will the transportation space look like? Where are things headed? How are things changing? You know, are you optimistic, pessimistic? Overall, if you look into your crystal ball, so to speak, what do you see?
In 10 to 15 years for New York City, or just for the industry?
For the industry in general.
In general, I think we're seeing trends now. You know, there's definitely going to be a lot more interest in, like you say, technologies are going to help us do better with what we have. Technologies are going to help us, you know, use the street better, manage the curb better. You know, and I think there's going to be a lot more sort of looking at the street space and trying to reimagine it. You know, for less, you know, for non-car uses, you know, because I think also, I'm sure in the next 10 to 15 years, there's going to be a lot more electric cars on the road. So, you know, they're going to have to figure out sort of how to figure out electric charging stations and you know, will they look like gas stations, or maybe will, you know, I know in some European cities, they've created sort of electric car charging plazas. Will there be some more of that? And since electric cars don't make a lot of noise and don't have emissions, can you also make it into sort of a park? Or, you know, I feel like a lot of this, you know, the resilient way of thinking is hopefully going to become more more widespread, which is, you know, to think about the multiple uses of things, you know, in order to maximize, you know, the uses, the value of certain things. Yeah, I do think we will still be, unfortunately, battling the car. There will still be personal cars, you know, on the road. They won't all go away by that point, I'm sure. But hopefully there will be more judicious use of them, and, you know, and they won't be the main mode of transport. And they're definitely not in the downtown dense parts of cities, you know. You never know. I mean, the thing I worry about sometimes is just that, you know, maybe we'll get to a point where the climate situation, or, you know, just the planetary health is so bad that there's just this draconian, you know, like, okay, no one can have a car anymore because we've like effed this up so royally.
Like Singapore, maybe.
Where they're just going to say you can't. And then it's all going to, and then it's going to be a scramble to figure out, okay, like, how do we, I mean, it'll be a good scramble, but, you know, I don't want it to get to that point where we're like having, where we are backs against the wall being like, okay, we have to figure this out right now, you know, and there's no like leeway to like, you know, plan for it and, you know, and you know, and work our way into a future where, you know, we're not so reliant on the car. But I don't know, I feel like, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. Okay, well, on that note, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to me. It was very fascinating, and, you know, I really am happy we got to cover all the topics that I wanted to. So it was a pleasure.
Well, thanks for having me, Matteo.